exactly how the wounds will be lined.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Well, first of all, I should thank the organizers for inviting me to be in Santa Barbara. It's great to be here. So as Peter said, I'm going to talk about this MIN system in E. coli and also in B. subtilis. And I think people who are here for the conference at the beginning of the sort of kickoff already heard a couple of talks about this. So there'll be some overlap with what you heard there. I guess only maybe half people heard that. Then at the end of the talk, there'll be some new stuff. So hopefully there'll be something for everyone. So let me begin by just saying a few words about organization in bacterial cells. The kind of old view of bacteria going back many years is that they're kind of a random bag full of stuff. So imagine your bacterial cell, and there's just a bunch of enzymes all floating around inside the bacterial cell. Well, as people have got better and better ideas about what's going on inside bacterial cells, it's clear that that old idea is completely untrue. And it's now clear that there are many processes where bacterial cells need accurate positional information in order to direct, to control and direct protein localization. So there are a bunch of proteins in bacterial cells that get sent to very specific locations within the cell at specific times. So some proteins will get sent to the ends of the cell for some purposes.
So just give us some scales.
Bacterium is about, in the case of E. coli, between 2 and 4 microns long and maybe 1 micron wide. And the bacteria I'm going to talk about today are all rod-shaped.
So that's, they are 2 by 1?
But they obviously they double in length between successive cell division events.
Right.
So maybe they start off at a couple of microns and maybe grow to be 4 microns long
and then
divide in half again. So those are the kind of length scales.
Microns long, 2 microns wide.
I think the width stays more or less constant, so it just gets longer.
So it's 2 1.
Yeah.
Not 4 1.
Yeah.
And the proteins, how big do we think? Typical protein, how big is that?
The actual size of the protein. These things are tiny, maybe like 50, 100 angstroms, that sort of size. Depends on the exact protein,
so
but that's the kind of size.
One.
We're talking, sort of like 10
nanometers.
Yeah.
So it's 10 nanometers.
Yeah.
So it's a factor of 100.
Right? Yeah.
Difference.
Yeah.
100 difference.
Yeah.
So
at least that.
Quite, it's not a big size difference.
No. Well, in fact, much later on, I'll talk more about discrete effects, but that's later on. So we'll come back to that issue. Yeah. Sure. So if what I'm going to talk about is all about rod-shaped bacteria. So there are many shaped bacteria, spheres, and all sorts of other stuff, but I'm going to concentrate on rod-shaped. And as I said, there are a whole bunch of processes where proteins get directed to specific locations inside the cell. So here's some examples. I'm going to talk almost exclusively about cell division, so I'll leave that for a moment. But there are plenty of others. One, for example, is chromosome and plasmid segregation. After the DNA has been replicated, it gets forced apart in the cell and gets sent usually to the 1/4 and 3/4 positions along the cell length. So one can ask, how does the DNA end up in that position? Sporulation, maybe I'll say a little bit about later on. That's basically, it's what happens when you stress a bacteria and put it in an unfavorable environment. And instead of dividing normally at the center of the cell, it forms basically a polar division septum and creates a spore, which is very hardy and can survive for a long time. So one could ask, how does it direct a whole bunch of proteins to the ends of the cell where it forms this spore? In signal transduction, there are, again, many signal transduction cell cycle control proteins, particularly in bacteria like Caulobacter, that have been very well studied, which, again, localize the ends of the cell. And there are many examples, too, in chemotaxis, where chemotactic receptors, again, polar localized. So there are many examples. I want to know, how is it that these proteins end up in specific locations? And that's what this talk's going to be about. And I'm going to focus on cell division and tell you first of all about E. coli, and at the end say something about B. subtilis.
So bacteria usually don't, they have these little motors or things that...
Bacteria don't have motors.
Flagella.
Oh, you mean flagella, yeah.
So they don't have flagella, or they do have flagella?
Yeah, they do have flagella. I thought you were going to say molecular motors for a second, but
right.
Bacteria don't have molecular motors,
molecular
as far as anyone knows.
They do not have molecular.
They do not have that. So they have to find other mechanisms for moving things around. At least when I say that they don't have molecular motors, everyone said the bacteria don't have a cytoskeleton, but that's false. Bacteria do have a kind of cytoskeleton. Yeah. So, yeah. That's very recent information. It's only been discovered in the last 2 years that there are bunch of proteins called MREB and MBL, which basically are cytoskeleton. So when you say that a bacteria doesn't have something, you know, this is subject to change. But as far as anyone knows, then there are no motors. Except, of course, there is a motor in the flagella.
Yeah, but that's
that's different.
That's,
yeah.
So otherwise, there's no active transport.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So let me tell you now about cell division. So the experimental fact is that cell division is targeted very accurately. So in E. coli, for example, which is rod-shaped, the E. coli bacteria can find its mid-plane halfway between the ends of the cell with very high accuracy. So accuracy of a few percent. And this is kind of a cartoon of what happens in the in cell division. So the first event is that this squiggle, which is the DNA, it gets replicated and then segregated. That's the first step. And once that's happened, a protein called FTC comes in and forms itself into a ring on the inside of the cytoplasmic membrane, as you can see here. Once that's happened, the cell membranes sort of invaginate at that point, and eventually the cell splits into two. So the question we want to answer very specifically in cell division is, how is it that this protein called FTC manages to get itself to be so precisely centered? Because once it's got there in the middle, then that triggers a whole bunch of other proteins to be recruited to the same site, and the cell splits in half. So it's critical that this ring forms in the right place. If this ring were to form here on top of the nucleoid, then that would be fairly disastrous, because it would sort of guillotine its own DNA, which would be extremely bad. And in principle, maybe even worse if this ring formed the end of the cell here, because then you'd end up with one cell with two copies of DNA in and one tiny cell with no DNA in, and that's called a mini cell. And if you interfere sufficiently with the mechanism of cell division, you can arrange for these mini cells to actually appear, which have absolutely no DNA in them at all.
You will tell what the ring really means? Is it thickening of the cell wall, or what means the ring?
Ring, okay. This FTSZ protein, there are about 20,000 or so copies of this thing, and it forms itself into a polymeric ring. So it nucleates at one point, and then it's inside the cytoplasmic membrane. So just lying on the inside, and once that ring is formed, there are, I think, at least 10 other proteins that get recruited to the same site. And no one really understands very well, you know, how the force is generated to get the cell to grow inwards. But fortunately, I didn't really have to understand that. At least it's important to understand, but it's not the topic of the talk. The topic of the talk is simply to understand how it is that this ring gets to be in the right place. Then there are many other poorly understood questions. But in many ways, cell division in bacteria is far worse understood than cell division in eukaryotes. So as I say, we want to understand how this ring gets to be in the middle of the cell. And there are a bunch of models that have been put forward over the years to try and explain this. The first idea, which was first proposed about 30 years ago, is potential division sites. So the idea here is that possible division sites are distinguished by so-called topological markers. So there's some protein, some molecule, which is sitting around in the cell, in the center of the cell, saying this is the location at which the cell should divide. Okay? But there's an obvious problem with that, because then you can simply ask the question, how did the topological marker itself find the center of the cell? Did the marker require its own marker to find the center of the cell, and, you know, just push back into a kind of regression? Exactly, turtles. Precisely. So that's not a very good explanation, although it was the prevailing explanation in any biological paper that was written up until a few years ago. But it doesn't quite seem to be adequate. So we need something else. And at least part of the explanation is something called nucleoid occlusion. And this is the idea that division is prevented at sites adjacent to the nucleoid. And by the way, the nucleoid is just the bacteria's version of the nucleus. Bacteria don't really have a nucleus, because they don't have a nuclear membrane. They have what's called a nucleoid instead. But the idea...
That just means the place where the DNA
is. It's all of a very, you know, tightly, yeah, exactly, localized and coiled up, precisely.
Right.
But it's usually not that localized.
Right.
Yes, it occupies a substantial fraction of the cell volume. That's certainly true. And that's why nucleoid occlusion can actually be effective, because it's actually a larger volume. So you can see that in this cartoon that this ring wouldn't want to form on top of these two areas of DNA. But that still doesn't explain why this ring ends up in the middle, because it could equally well come at the end, which is also pretty much DNA-free. Yeah.
So experimentally, that's, you know, where the nuclear is, that's quite, where the DNA is, that's, I mean, it's really like you've drawn it.
Yeah, it's not as clear cut as that ever. Yes, that's true. But it does occupy a fairly discrete region. People have done experiments to actually look where these rings appear. And they've observed they don't appear on top of the nucleoids, or at least only rarely do that. Or at least they only do it when you've messed around with certain of the proteins involved in this. Then you can get it to do it. But it doesn't want to form on top. But no one actually knows why. The molecular mechanism of the interaction between the DNA and this ring is not understood. It's just basically an observation. But even if, you know, it appears to be true, but nevertheless, it doesn't explain why this ring comes in the middle as opposed to the ends. So we still need something else.
You say why I'm confused between the different use of the name. There is how it happened and why it happened. What do they say about why should it happen exactly at the center?
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about, hopefully.
Why you mean how in the mechanism or why in functional?
Why in function is it important to the bacteria? It's probably not important that it gets it absolutely 50-50. I don't think it would care if it was 55-45. It really does care if it tries to form a division septum here, because then it will slice its own DNA in half. And if it gets it at the end, you'll end up with a cell with two sets of DNA and one set with no DNA. So it's important that it's reliably in the center.
So
okay?
You say that the precision that they observe 2% is just accidental and not really...
There is a claim back in the literature from 20 years ago that it's 1% or 2% accurate, which I actually don't believe, because I don't know how they can do the experiment that accurately. And I spoke to someone in Stanford last week, and he confirmed that he didn't believe this either. But nevertheless, it's accurate, okay? And there's a good reason for that. But I want to explain, too, why it's accurate, okay? Okay, so we've had potential division sites, nucleoid occlusion, and the third thing which I'm going to spend the rest of the talk telling about is what's called the MIN system, which is a bunch of proteins which are the primary means of regulation. And I'm going to talk, first of all, about E. coli. Well, there are these MIN proteins, there are three of them, MIN-C, MIN-D, and MIN-E. And at the end, I'm going to talk about another bacteria, B. subtilis, which has MIN-C and MIN-D, but it doesn't have MIN-E. It has a different protein called DIV4A. And hopefully at the end of the talk, I might be able to convince you that the mechanisms which these two bacteria use are actually different, quite different, even though they share two of the same three proteins. So let me tell you a bit more detail about what these three proteins actually do. And this is summarizing about 10 years experimental work onto one slide. So I'm not really doing justice to the, you know, really fantastic experiments that have been done over the last decade. First of all, MIN-C. So MIN-C is very important because it actually prevents division by interfering with the construction of the FTSE ring. So MIN-C actually basically depolymerizes this ring, which forms on the inside the cytoplasmic membrane. Okay, so that's important. The problem with MIN-C is it's usually in the wrong place. MIN-C is a cytoplasmically localized protein, which means it's in the wrong place because this FTSE ring forms on the cell membrane. So if this MIN-C is going to be effective in interfering with this FTSE ring, it has to get itself onto the membrane. It doesn't do that naturally on its own. So that's where the second protein, MIN-D, comes in. It has the nice property that it self-associates to the membrane. And what's more, it binds to MIN-C and recruits it to the membrane where it can be effective. So the idea is that MIN-C and MIN-D bind, they go to the membrane, and there they block cell division by interfering with this FTSE ring. Because if the cell can't form this FTSE ring, it can't divide. Okay, it won't divide at all. And in fact, if you just have MIN-C and MIN-D and not the third protein, then this is exactly what happens. MIN-C, MIN-D bind, they go to the membrane, they block cell division, but they block it everywhere along the length of the cell. So the cell can't divide anywhere and just keeps on getting longer and longer and longer, and you get these enormously long filamentous cells. And I'll show you some pictures in a bit. And lastly, we have MIN-E. That's also recruited to the membrane by MIN-D, and it removes the mid-cell division block in a way in which I'll tell you about. So MIN-E is critical.
So this is a very important observation. I mean, this is...
Oh, yeah.
This is not trivial.
Oh, no. No, no, because we're going to use this information to build the model, right? Because, I mean, we didn't just cook up the interactions that I'm going to give you later on. They're actually based on experiments.
So this is all done by knockouts?
It's a combination. This sort of thing, yeah. So, for example, if I want to know what happens to a system without MinE, then you just delete it, put them back in on the plasmids, and then you observe what happens to them. And by GFP tagging, and I'll show you some pictures.
GFP tagging.
Yeah, which is what you see here. So the real shock, which was discovered by Pete De Boer in his lab in Case Western about 4 years ago now, was that these proteins are not static objects within the cell. Actually, they're highly dynamic. And in fact, when you have MinE, then that stimulates coherent pole-to-pole oscillations of all three proteins, MinC, MinD, and MinE. And as I just said, this is observed by this miracle technique of GFP fusion. So you tag your protein in question to this green fluorescent protein and do a fluorescent microscopy experiment. And in a live bacteria, you can see where these proteins are. And that has absolutely, completely revolutionized this field, because none of this would have been possible without this technique. I mean, no one had any idea that there was this sophistication in bacterial structure before these techniques came along. So this is an experiment from Pete De Boer's lab, which is MinD tagged to green fluorescent protein, GFP. So what you can see here, this number is the time in seconds, and the bright patch here is where there's a high concentration of MinD. And you can see this MinD starts out at one end of the cell, then after about 10 seconds, half of it's relocated to the other end, and it sits there for a while, and then after about a minute, it comes back to where it started. And you can see there's a little bit of bleaching going on in the experiment, but you can see this thing is oscillating with a time scale of about a minute.
How long do the cells survive, do you know?
They're perfectly happy with the GFP tagging. It doesn't seem to affect
them. I know, but once they get observed, they just...
Oh, I don't know that. I don't know. There's certainly bleaching going on. I don't know how long, whether you're killing them by shining a light on them. I don't know.
You might do,
yeah.
Eukaryotic cells, you do.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. In that case, these ones probably also suffering.
They're suffering quite a bit.
Okay. So these oscillations, they say, have a period of about a minute, and the complete life cycle, which it, between successive cell division events, the minimum time in E. coli is 20 to 30 minutes. So you can see there are many of these oscillations between successive division events. So that's obviously an important observation.
Can you just for sure that there's really moving back and forth and then just oscillating?
Yeah, I'll come back. That's a very important point, actually. And I'll come back. There's an experiment which demonstrates that these guys are moving.
Yeah.
It's not that they're being synthesized in one part of the cell, broken down, and resynthesized somewhere else. That's not what's happening. That's very important, actually. I'll come back to that point. So that was what MinD does, and MinC does exactly the same. But you wouldn't be able to tell the difference if I'd shown you the MinC data. This is what happens to MinE, and in some ways it's even more tantalizing.
The same green fluorescent protein, you can tell it what to attach to?
Yeah. I guess you change the sequence of these things, and you add it in to the end, You form a protein which is fused to this GFP, and then you can see where it is. So you can attach the same GFP to whatever protein you want. So that's the magic. And the magic, what's more is, it doesn't seem to affect the functions of many proteins. Not true for all proteins.
It's like you put it into the DNA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
remember, again, when the protein gets expressed, it also expresses the GFP.
Yeah.
Or the YFP.
Yeah.
Or
whatever,
RFP. Or whatever.
There are a whole bunch of these now, actually. Originally, there was just green, but now there's yellow, red, cyan, and
different GFPs now.
Yeah.
You're not worried that this itself plays a role.
You have to be careful. There is some evidence that if you're not careful, if you're not aware that it can cause artifacts. For example, it's known that it can cause artificial polar localization. Sometimes you see these guys clustered at the end, and that seems to be an effect of the GFP. But it seems to be remarkable to me that it has a very little effect on a wide array of proteins. I mean, you can't do it to any protein. There's some which you can't fuse and they're non-functional. But you can do it to very many.
They know where to splice it. I mean, if they know the protein, they can actually
figure out where to splice it. So you can There's some you can splice it to the N terminal, but not the C terminal, or vice versa. And so you have to be a bit careful at where you put it sometimes. That's absolutely right. But in this case, it seems to be fine as far as anyone knows.
So they just develop as the other ones do.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you're not shining light on them, they're perfectly happy. They just you know, they live, the reproduce. Yeah. There's no problem there.
So does it happen when the cells are not dividing?
This oscillation?
Yeah.
Yes, it seems to be happening. It happens all the time, essentially, within the cells. It's not just happening when the cells are about to divide. It's happening continuously throughout the cell life cycle. Yeah. Okay. So we've seen what min D does. Now, min E. So they said this forms a ring-shaped structure within the cell. And this is now a min E GFP experiment. And you can see that this ring is moving inside the cell. And this arrowhead here is denoting the direction of movement. And again, this is from Pete DeBoer's lab. And this number, again, is a time in seconds. And you can see this ring starts off in the center of the cell, pushes towards the cell end, kind of becomes, the signal becomes diffuse, reappears back in the middle, pushes towards the other cell end, becomes diffuse, comes back into the center, and so the process continues.
But it can't reappear.
Well, I'm being loose with language. Yes, it comes off the membrane actually, and becomes the signal becomes diffuse throughout the cell, and then it re-aggregates again.
It seems like it has disappeared.
Yeah, exactly. I'm being loose with language there. You're probably right to catch me.
Is the signal already present when you are in the phase where the DNA gets separated, because that's already the kind of creation of the symmetry?
Yeah, I mean, these oscillations are going on, I think, all the time in the cell cycle. So, including when the DNA is being replicated.
So, a cell that just divided, that's already there.
A cell which just divided, it's an interesting question about how the oscillation gets set up then. I mean, we'll come to the model later on, but what I see from the model later on, this thing is a self-organized process and will form itself very rapidly after cell division, even because then you can imagine when the cells actually divide the signal, the oscillation becomes quite corrupted.
So the two daughter cells, do they have the same, so they synchronize?
Experiment hasn't been done.
The transfer at the beginning, you actually saying this is transport
yes.
as opposed to destruction
yes.
and recreation?
Yes, exactly. I'll come on to that in a moment. That's important. Okay. Okay. So that's what min E does. Okay, so these proteins are oscillating back and forth, but the question is, that's all very nice, but what does that have to do with the process of cell division? And
for this mechanism to happen, you really need the membrane is going to be important.
Yes, very important.
Right.
It's not just transport of the bulk. There's stuff happening on the
membrane. Stuff happening on the membrane. That's crucial, but just hold on for 10 minutes and we'll get to it, okay? Okay, so the key point here is these guys are oscillating back and forth, but the center of the cell is marked by a minimum of the min C and min D concentration. So I go back to the previous slide. You can see this min D, and remember the min C does exactly the same. It's always at the ends of the cell. It's almost like a square wave oscillation. If you look at the center of the cell here, basically the signal is always black. So the concentration is low in the center of the cell. These things are oscillating back and forth, but it's never in the middle. And remember that the min C protein has an effect on FTZ, which is this essential protein which forms itself into this ring. So this FTZ protein is going to want to form where the min C concentration is lowest, because the min C depolymerizes the FTZ. That means the FTZ is going to want to form in the middle of the cell. So that's basically how this is working in a sort of biochemical way. But the question then arises, how are these oscillations driven and controlled? What's the mechanism which is creating this extremely interesting oscillatory phenomenology? So that's what I want to talk about. But this is one very big clue. This is what happens to min D in a filamentous cell. And what you can do is you can delete FTC, and as I said earlier, if you delete FTC, then it's an essential protein. And if you do it, the cell can't divide anymore. It just keeps on getting longer and longer and longer and longer. And that's what you see here. You see these enormously long filamentous cells. I think it's about 5 microns or something. So it's long.
Where the DNA went? effects? Is it also distributed periodically?
No, I don't. Not as periodically as this. No.
Okay.
I mean, I'm trying to remember. I think there are multiple nucleoids in here. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think because the DNA replication continues.
Well, it had to, right?
Yeah.
But the question is it actually?
No, it's not as periodic as this.
Not as periodic as this.
No, it tends to be more sort of randomly spaced. But when you see these pictures, I mean, at least when I first saw them a few years ago, immediately gave me a hint as to what's actually going on here, because it's very clear evidence for a characteristic wavelength. You can see when you make the cell longer, you can imagine what might happen is the oscillations just get slower and they're sort of sweeping back and forth in the cell, but it takes longer to do it. But that's not what happens at all. Instead, what happens is you get two bands of oscillations forming. So instead of doing this, it's doing this. So you've got two wavelengths effectively fitting inside the cell. So it's telling you that there is a characteristic wavelength which is not really dependent on the geometry of the cell. So if you make the cell longer, you can squeeze more wavelengths into it. And here you can see multiple wavelengths.
I don't understand. What is the white?
The white is where there is a high concentration of I think this is MinD.
Are these averages?
No, this is a snapshot. So what you can see here is the MinD starts off in the middle at time zero. 20 seconds later, some of it's relocated to this end, and some of it's relocated to the other end. Okay, and then a bit later, it's come back to the center. Whereas before, what we had is it just jumped from one end to the other and back again. Here, it's like it's jumped from the end to the center, and then after a while, it goes back to the ends again. So you can see there are two bands here, not one.
So the transport's kind of locally back and forth.
Right. Exactly. It's not going all the way to the end of the cell anymore. It's only going halfway.
But if it's going from one end to the other,
mm-hmm.
then if you took a snapshot in the intermediate time, it'd be a lot in the middle.
Okay, that's what I said. It's basically a square wave oscillation. It's at one end of the cell, then it moves very rapidly to the other end of the cell. And then it sits there for a bit, and then it moves very rapidly back to the other end of the cell.
So in some sense, it's an average.
Well, it's typical snapshots at different times in this cycle. I wouldn't say it's an average. No.
You could also take a snapshot at this short time where it's in the middle.
I mean, what was done before is that people didn't look at sufficient resolution and they didn't see this oscillation. That certainly happened for min E. For many years, people thought the min E was a static object ring situated in the center of the cell. And the reason they thought that is because they hadn't looked at sufficient time resolution to see this oscillation, and they just saw an average. And then you miss all of this. Okay.
But does a wavelength compare with a dimensional cell
yes.
that is able to divide?
Yes. That's important, actually. You don't
what one would expect.
You don't want the wavelength to be too short. Because if the wavelength was too short, it would suddenly split up into two wavelengths before it's divided. And remember, as I said before, the cell basically doubles in length between division events, and that would corrupt the system, I think. Okay, so the last experimental slide I wanted to show you for the time being is simultaneous imaging of MinD and MinE. So now they've both been fused to GFP. Now it makes it a little bit confusing because now it's difficult to disentangle the signal of one from the other. I think you can now tag them to different fluorescent proteins, but there were technical problems with that, which have only been overcome in the last year. So this is slightly older data. But the interpretation from the experimentalists on this is never brilliantly clear, this, but I'll do my best. The idea is this arrowhead, these two arrowheads here, you can see like a bright blob there and a bright blob there, and then another bright blob at the end of the cell. Okay, with a bit of imagination, perhaps you can see those. And the interpretation is that these two bright dots are the min-E ring, and this bright stuff at the end is the min-D. So what's happening then is that the two dots are basically this ring here, the min-E, and the signal at the end of the cell is basically the min-D, which you can see here. Oops, wrong way. So the idea is that this min-E ring is pushing in towards the end of the cell, and as it's doing so, it's expelling the min-D, which is sitting at the end of the cell there. So it's a bit later, this mini ring's pushing in, then this min D is coming back at the other end of the cell. So basically the mini ring pushes in towards the end, the min D, which is sitting there, is being forced off the membrane, and then it's coming, rebinding back at the other end of the cell. That's really the interpretation. So min E forms a dynamical ring that drives min D off the membrane, is the interpretation. So let me come now.
If it's in the body of the cytoplasm, you wouldn't see it.
The signal is more diffuse when it's in the cytoplasm. It's basically moving rapidly from one location to the other. In fact, the concentrations in the cytoplasm are always quite low. It's only there sort of transiently while it's relocating to another position.
So the idea is you have the cylinder.
Yeah.
You have min whatever, you know, the one that what throws the stuff off the membrane?
Min E kicks min D off the membrane.
Okay, so you have min D bound to the membrane.
Yes.
Min E comes along, throws it back into the bulk.
Yes.
Now the bulk can diffuse freely.
Exactly.
Because there's no active transport.
Exactly.
But it diffuses and gets bound somewhere as a sink. The sink is on the other side of the
membrane. The sink is as far away from the min E as it can get, which is the other end of the cell.
Well, because there's no min E there.
Yes.
And so now it gets
exactly.
It gets
so you're
attached.
Exactly.
But now the question is, why does min E go away?
Because it just, after a while, all the min D comes off the membrane, and the min E just has some sort of half-life on the membrane. It just unbinds at some point. Okay, and then when it, this is all in the model, when it rebinds back to the membrane, it needs min D to rebind.
Oh, it needs min D to rebind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because min E is normally cytoplasmic. Without that, this would all stop.
Right.
Exactly. So they're basically sort of three key elements. You need the min D bind spontaneously. Min E needs to have min D to get on the membrane. But once it's there, min E forces min D off the membrane. And it's those sort of ingredients that when you put this into any sort of sensible mathematical model, you get out these oscillations. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
We had already two lectures, two different models,
yes.
And they showed the same.
This is one of them. This is the root.
You are the first one.
I'm the first one, yes.
Okay.
And I'll talk about the other models later, okay?
Related to the other models.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. So I'm going to, this is work which my collaborators come at the end, but this is work I've done with Andy Rutenberg. So I'm the first of the two speakers.
This is the first one.
I'll talk about the other models later. This is kind of the first generation model. There are now models that have come after this first generation model, which have been able to take advantage of more data that's come out in the 2 years since we first wrote this down. So there are models which have more detail, I think, about some of the fundamental processes. But it's exactly the same assumptions, okay?
From the assumption of Eagle-Mayo.
It depends on what I'll get to that. Let me move on, and then I will talk about that in a few slides, okay. But first, there are two experimental observations I want to tell you about, which are very important. The first is that the min C dynamics is slave to min D, okay. And so that means we can basically remove min C from our modeling because it does the same as min D does. It just reduces the number of equations by two, which is nice. And in fact, if you delete min C from the bacteria, then the oscillations still happen perfectly happily, still keep on oscillating. They're not functional anymore because you need the min C to interfere with the foot C, okay? But the oscillations still happen perfectly happily. Now, the second point, which is very important, which I think a couple of people already asked, maybe Peter, that the oscillations continue even if protein synthesis is blocked. So what you can do is you can add, you can sort of feed the bacteria chloramphenicol, which is an antibiotic, and that shuts down protein synthesis. That's how it kills the bacteria. But nevertheless, when you do an experiment that does that, the oscillations continue perfectly happily. So that's telling you very clearly that what's going on in the cell is not protein sort of breakdown and then resynthesis somewhere else. It's actually relocation of these proteins, okay? So that's important. So now let me just come on to our model, which is, I think of all the models that have been put forward to describe this, our model has the virtue of being the simplest, which is something of a virtue. Now, I don't want to go through all the terms in this, but I do want to focus on one term, which I've sort of set up in the previous slide to try and justify in more detail. Because remember, this min E ring is moving in, and it's kicking off the min D, which is at the end of the cell. Okay, so the interpretation is min E kicks min D off the membrane. And that's precisely what we have here. So we have four equations, two describing min D, one for the cytoplasm and one for the membrane, and two describing min E. Again, that's the cytoplasm and that's the membrane. And we allow all of these proteins to diffuse in principle. Okay, so they can diffuse along the length of the cell. And then there are a bunch of terms which are describing how the proteins bind and unbind from this, from the membrane. Okay, and that's all that there is in this model. It's just diffusion and membrane binding and unbinding. And we're going to try and justify, at least as far as we can, some of these terms using the molecular biology data, some of which I've shown you in the previous slides. And in particular, this term here corresponds to MinD coming off the membrane and into the cytoplasm. And this is exactly that term I was showing you a moment ago. This is, so the rate at which MinD comes off is also proportional to the local density of MinD, but it's also proportional to the local density of MinE. That was the interpretation from the experiments, and there's some rate constant associated with that.
Membrane.
Yes, there's a membrane density, so that's why they have the small letters there. And you know, you can do an effort to justify some of these other terms in a similar way. I'd say it's not a perfect model, but I think it encapsulates a lot of what's going on inside the cell.
You know these numbers like a diffusion coefficient independent?
Exactly. We'll come to that in a moment. The only numbers there's any experimental data for the diffusion constants. And there isn't really very good data for that even. There is diffusion constant of one, well, basically two proteins have been measured by Elowitz a few years back. But it's not a protein which is related to any of the ones involved in this system. I think they measured it from Molto's binding protein, completely different. So at least we can, maybe these numbers are a little on the small side, but we can get at least the correct order of magnitude for diffusion constant. It's sort of order of 1 µm² per second. The other numbers we more or less have to guess, and there isn't really much data. But we have to be sure that when we put these numbers in, that there is a good degree of robustness. Obviously, it would be fatal if I put these numbers in, I change one of them by 1% and everything, you know, everything collapsed and a sort of, you know, a pile of ashes or whatever. We certainly wouldn't want that. But fortunately, these numbers are quite robust. And actually, when I was originally doing this and constructing this computer model, you know, I found reasonable numbers within an hour or two. You know, this is like a 10-dimensional phase space, right? And I would not be able to find any reasonable numbers within an hour or two if this wasn't quite robust. So, and I wasn't doing anything fancy, like, you know, sophisticated computerized parameter search. This was, you know, changing numbers by hand, recompiling the program, and watching the display, and then repeating this many, many times.
So the experiments, so independent experiments to determine these numbers, are not indirectly kind of retrieved from these oscillations.
Well, you can attempt to do that. The problem is the models that we've written so far are you know, fairly idealized, and for example, they're one-dimensional models. So everything is projected down to one dimension. So I don't think it's in principle possible to go from these numbers to an experimental number. Because you know, somehow you've taken out a lot of the degrees of freedom of the problem. There's some sort of complicated projection that's happened. So I think that the level at which the modeling is at the moment is more sort of conceptual understanding of what are the principles you have to put into this to get out this kind of oscillating phenomenology. I wouldn't trust the numbers.
So even the orders of, I mean, the signals, they're all made up, right?
They're all made up, yeah.
Sure. They were reasonable?
I think so. But you can argue about that.
Yeah. They reveal the 1 minute at the end of the day.
Exactly. And okay, I'm not sure. I don't think I have the slide because I have too many other things I want to tell you about. But the point is that for these parameters, there is a linear instability to an oscillatory state. So if you do linear stability analysis on this, you get out an oscillatory pattern, basically. And also from that linear stability analysis, you can extract a time period and a wavelength. And the time period, I think, was about 100 seconds, and the wavelength was about 4 µm. It's not completely crazy.
So right. There are certain constraints in the signals.
Yes.
Because you have some equations which
right.
you have to fulfill.
Right, and they have to want them to do the oscillations. You know, they want to get the right length
so
scale, want to get the right time scale.
On others.
Well, in that sense, you could try and constrain them by the available experimental data. That's true. But I think there's probably a fairly large region which will fit the bill. Because it's quite robust, you know, which is something you have to have. If it weren't robust, I wouldn't trust it, which means I can't get that much information out from that type of analysis, I think. So the idea is that there is this instability to an oscillatory state, and any so if I started out with a flat distribution, perturbed it slightly, this perturbation would grow and grow, and you set up these oscillations spontaneously. And this is kind of an analog of these Turing structures, which have, you know, have very long history in mathematical biology, going back 50 years or so. But the beauty of this particular system is that there's so much experimental data. We know what the morphogens are. You know, we know what the patterns look like. We know there's a characteristic wavelength. There's so much more information than there often is in these pattern-forming systems.
It's very easy to get oscillations. Mm-hmm. What's not easy is to get wavelengths. Mm-hmm. And that is, as you say, is the fact that you have more than two
right.
morphogens.
Yes,
different
exactly. That's precise. That's the really key feature which is setting up, as Pierre says, is these. It's a difference in the diffusion constants, right? Well, when they're diffusing in cytoplasm, they're moving very rapidly. When they're on the membrane, they're essentially stuck, because you'll notice that I put zero in for the diffusion constant here. And actually, I will come back a bit later to why biologically that's very reasonable. Actually, some exciting. No, it has to be small. So for convenience, we say, okay, we'll put it zero here. You're right, you can make this a small, obviously it's much smaller than this. It's the normal Turing instability thing. You have to have at least an order of magnitude difference. But the problem, I think, in many biological systems was to actually arrange to get that difference in diffusion constant. It's not so straightforward if the stuff is just in a solution. Here you have the massive advantage of having a membrane, which kind of makes the diffusion constant small, you know, very naturally in one region.
From the experiment it first sounded, if there's a very strong dimension effect, because you have the cytoplasm and the membrane,
yes.
Wouldn't that reflect somehow also in the 1D problem that the boundary conditions are sort of crucial or not?
Well, the boundary conditions that are in the model are just simply hard wall, so you know nothing leaks out the end. Okay, so you have to remember, what is this model? It's two one-dimensional lines, and stuff is going in from one to the other, and nothing can leak out the end. So it's an incredibly idealized model of what's going on. And actually, the remarkable thing is you get so much out of it. You know, and there may be, again, reasons for why the one-dimensional model is working better, probably, than you have any reason to expect it to. But I'll come back to that. So this is a numerical simulation, and I should tell you immediately that it looks like it's two dimensions. It's not. It's one dimension. It was. It just looks like two dimensions, but it's not.
That's to help your imagination.
The rounding is completely 100% artificial. So I don't want anyone to be confused about it. Because basically Simon, a graduate student, did this, and it looks so pretty, so we'll just keep it. So what you can see here is it's just a straightforward numerical integration of these equations. There's no fancy techniques to integrate this. You don't need anything sophisticated. And you can see these guys oscillating back and forth. You can see the min D goes from here to here. The white is high concentration. And then you can see its mini forms in the middle and moves in towards the end.
So discrete, that's just the way you plotted it?
Sorry, why?
It looks discrete. That's because you've got that discrete.
It's probably. I don't know how many colors we're using in the simulator. It could be that. And also, there are also a finite number of lattice sites in the simulation.
I'll show you a red line.
Yes.
A blue line, and you would actually see how dynamics really looks.
Well, I'm going to show you that next because I don't think that's. This looks nice, and because it's PowerPoint, I have to have some sort of idiotic movie in the presentation.
There's no geometry.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, even you say it's one-dimensional, but even in one, I mean, the geometry of a membrane and a bulk is not
exactly.
Why is that two-dimensional?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that something has to diffuse to get to the membrane is not in there, and
that's a two-dimensional.
Yeah, and that means that, as I said before, all the parameters you can't, you know, they're all sort of renormalized in some complicated way, and you know, but one of the reasons I didn't want to go to a full three-dimensional model is I still don't think that enough is known about what happens sort of microscopically and the sort of biochemistry of all this to make it worthwhile going to a 3D model. You could get that sort of geometry correct while still having other features that were not right, and it would sort of invalidate. You make it a bit pointless going so far in one direction when you haven't gone equally far in other directions in the model to make it accurate. So that's why I didn't bother. And actually something that I'll talk about in a few slides' time, I think justifies why I didn't bother doing that, and some new data. So this, I think, Eberhard pointed out, this is a much better way of displaying the same data. This is a space-time plot. And this is for min D and min E, and the white is high concentration. So you can see these guys oscillating back and forth. And really the key thing is when you do a time average, you see the MinD is nicely minimized in the center of the cell. That's really the key thing. So that comes out of this model. That is, things oscillate back and forth. The minimum concentration is in the center, and that means that's exactly where this foot Z is going to want to form.
That's really capital V and capital E, or is it little
E? Okay, this is MinD. Okay, this is on the membrane. Actually,
the membrane.
It's rho little d, I guess.
Okay,
yeah.
Rho little d.
But even if I took the complete density, it would look almost identical because the density in the cytoplasm is very low. So what basically happens is these guys come off the membrane, they then diffuse very rapidly in here and then rebind somewhere else. So the densities in the cytoplasm are always a factor of 10 lower than in the
determine how
on the membrane.
It is by the sigma that you used, the values of sigma.
Yeah. And also, it's important that this is a fairly sharp minimum. Actually, I'll come back to that in a moment.
The right one, how do you get these relatively, it looks like a step almost.
Yeah, this just comes out of the dynamics. I haven't done anything to get it to do that. But remember, the min E formed itself into a ring-shaped thing spontaneously. And that's pretty much what we see here. Although it's a fat ring, but it's certainly sort of qualitatively doing something that's fairly similar.
Because you have a different reaction term for the E.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And notice, too, that when you do an average, the min E is maximized in the center. And There haven't been any recent experiments on that, but the older experiments always found a central min-E ring. And I think that was because they didn't have enough time resolution to see the oscillation. And you see again that when you do this average, you do end up with a central min-E maximum.
It should be trivial to ask the experimentalists to take the pictures and let them off.
Absolutely. I've spoken to them. It'd be nice if they did it.
If they still have the pictures, they just have to let them off.
Yeah. Okay, so some of you have heard other talks about this. I wanted to say a word about some of the other models, because we're not the only people to have done this. There are now, I think, three. I know of three. There may be more. I don't know. But basically, they all share a fundamental reaction diffusion mechanism. So they're all using the type of model which I wrote down. But there are some differences. The first is a model by Meinhardt and de Boer. So Meinhardt's very well known from pattern formation. De Boer's actually one of the experimentalists. But their model requires continuous protein synthesis. Yet it's known that when you add chloramphenicol, this antibiotic, it shuts off protein synthesis and the oscillations still continue. So though I think the idea there is right, that it's a reaction diffusion instability, I think the implementation, the structure of the equations, I don't think is completely correct. Because
synthesis of what?
Of MinD and MinE. It requires those proteins to be being made all the time. And amongst other things, that's amazingly inefficient for the bacteria. Imagine it has to synthesize all this stuff. It immediately gets broken down. Then it has to synthesize another 2,000 copies at the other end, and then they get broken down. It has to, over the cell cycle, it's making hundreds of thousands of extra copies that it doesn't have to. So it's woefully inefficient, amongst other things, actually. But also experimentally, I don't think this is quite right. Then a few months...
That makes sense. And you say that, especially the experimental evidence, that if you block...
Yes,
or you
exactly.
Make the bacteria
exactly.
Starve or whatever,
precisely.
Continues.
Exactly. So I don't think this, but the idea that it's reaction diffusion instability is right. But the structure of the equations, I think, is in error.
Right.
Okay. Now there's another model by Karsten Kruse, which came out a few months after ours, and that's actually quite similar to our model. It has some slightly different assumptions in it, but it's overall quite similar. Then there's our paper and those two, I guess, were the sort of first generation, and they're. They all appeared within a few months of each other about 18 months ago. And then there's some new work, I think, by Wingreen and co-workers. And as far as I know, that hasn't been published. So my information about that model is by downloading a presentation from here. So I'm not really an expert on what they've done. But as far as I understand it, they have a slightly more complicated model in that they've also included ATP dynamics, which I haven't actually talked about, but one needs to include that. And so they have an extra equation, basically, which takes into account how ATP is consumed in this cycle.
In the bulk or in the
other membrane? I think they have an extra equation for how MinD recombines with ATP in the bulk, I think. Yeah, because when MinD comes off the membrane, basically it's MinE induced ATP hydrolysis
you
when MinD comes off.
ATP for the absorption and release of the protein
from the membrane.
Balance, and then they have a higher degree of freedom because you realize that in your model, it's very sensitive to sigma. So in some sense, if comparing to your model, isn't it, that ATP controls the sigma. Sigma can change.
Right, I mean, our model doesn't have ATP in at all. The sort of hidden assumption in our model is that as soon as stuff comes off the membrane, it can recombine with ATP very rapidly and rebind immediately. But they have this extra step where they actually specifically include that recombination.
So this would be, if I compare to your model, it's like making the sigma themselves a dynamic.
Yes, variables. Yes, exactly, exactly, yeah. So, and you know, the ATP dynamics is certainly in there, and it should be in the model. So I think their model is certainly a useful contribution, you know, and it includes an extra effect that's not in our model. But I would say that there are basically no new principles in their model. It's essentially, the structure of the equations is similar to ours. It's a conserved reaction, so conserved in the sense it doesn't require protein synthesis. Things are just swapping positions all the time. And it's using a reaction diffusion instability. But they have, I think, somewhat better agreement with experiment because of this extra, they have another degree of freedom, so they can get better agreement. And you know, they've had the advantage, I think, of some of the new data.
I understand that because you adjust the signals.
Yeah, but I mean, they have an extra degree of freedom.
What do you mean by better agreement? Experiment, are you going to tell us?
Well, what they
mentioned some.
There's one thing that you could criticize our model for, in that when this MinD comes back, it rebinds a little bit too centrally. You could say that maybe the MinD should rebind over here. Okay, and their model does that better. Okay, I mean, you could argue that maybe if I tweak the parameters in my model, I get my model to do better. But I purposely didn't tweak the parameters in my model because I didn't want to make it look too good. Because I, you know, it's not a perfect model. There are lots of idealizations and approximations and maybe whatever has gone into it. I didn't want to over-optimize it because that would be fake in a sense.
At least my understanding was.
Yeah.
So you take your model and not remember which of the sigma makes it sharp. This MinD.
MinD.
Yeah, one of this value of the sigma.
Yeah.
So if I understood correctly what they have that this sigma, let's say that to make it sharper, you want this sigma to be faster. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So it seems as if this sigma depends on the concentration. So when you have low concentration, you make it even faster, so it makes it sharper.
Yeah.
That was my naive understanding of what. But
I mean, I think there's one thing I should say is that even, you know, all the models, as I'll come to in a moment, to an extent are wrong, because there's a big effect isn't really in any of the models at the moment, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And that's why, you know, it's important to keep on adding these extra effects, but there's a lot of stuff which is not in any of the models at the moment. So I don't think you can say any more at the moment other than that these are the correct principles which are going into these models, and we're getting some sort of, and it's showing you now that there's this multiplicity of models that actually has a great deal of robustness. Because as long as I write down any sort of more or less sensible model that includes MinD binding, MinD and MinE binding cooperatively, MinE kicking MinD off the membrane, and I put some reasonable numbers in, then I'm going to get out moderately sensible looking behavior. And then one can argue about what the exact dynamics you should put in, and that's important. But
at least the two models there and yours, it's the same framework.
Exactly.
And precisely. The other model is a completely different principle of synthesis.
Exactly. So I think Yazid, that other model is not so good, and the model that we've written down, and also Carsten Kruse and the new model, all share the correct basic instability, which is the right one, I think, and then they just differ on some of the details and on, you know, exactly which biological phenomena are put in. But again, to emphasize, they're all incomplete.
As you pointed out at the beginning, I mean, they're just very robust because
you have
a difference in diffusion constants.
Yes, exactly. And that's
what's happening in your model when you make it longer?
Indeed, what happens now when you make it longer is it splits up into two bands, exactly as you see in the experiments.
Okay.
Yeah, which again is important. And actually, it's also good that it gives a characteristic wavelength of about the right length. It gives 4 microns for the characteristic wavelength, and that's also right ballpark. You don't want it to be too short.
Yeah, but that's because you have 0.28 or whatever microns square per second diffusion, right?
Right. Okay, you can change that.
It's changed, right?
Yeah, but with these numbers, it works quite nicely. Okay. Right. So that's a discussion of other people's work. Now back to some stuff that I have done with Andrew. So this is now about fluctuation. So I don't think anyone else has done this. You have no option but to listen to our work now. So I think earlier on, maybe I didn't point it out, but there are a relatively small number of these proteins. There are about 1 or 1,500 copies of each of these proteins. So one can immediately start worrying about fluctuation effects. Okay, that could be significant. In particular, if the fluctuations become too small, you might worry, well, maybe the fluctuations completely corrupt the oscillations and just wipe them out, because there's too much noise. In principle, that could happen. Also, one could ask interesting questions like, does E. coli use a kind of optimal concentration of pattern-forming proteins? Is there any mileage in asking that kind of question? Well, in order to answer that, there are a couple of ways forward. One is to write down a stochastic PDE. So you write down a diffusion equation like we did before, and there's some F of rho, which is describing the binding and unbinding. And then there's some noise associated with this, which will be multiplicative in this case. The problem with that is this is extremely difficult to do practically. And the problem is that the densities are often very low, and that makes it very difficult to write down this kind of equation. Even in principle, there are big issues. And some of the problems are that it's very easy to get the densities driven negative because the noise becomes so large. It tends to drive the densities negative. If they're close to zero, you have a fluctuation and it pushes the densities negative.
Yeah, they get multiplicative, so you can chop it off.
Well, you can do certain things like, you know, artificially chopping it off at zero, but it's not clear. You know, that's a rather ad hoc thing to do. It's not clear whether that's actually the correct thing to do.
Thermal noise is much bigger.
No, this is just sort of just small number noise, as it were. The fact that you don't have very many particles, right, is giving rise to this. And I particularly have large regions in the cell where the density is effectively zero because they're all at one end, and there's a large region where there are very few of them. And that just makes it technically difficult, because it's known that if you just write down this kind of stochastic PDE normally, it is not well defined in the limit of low densities. You just can't write this equation at all.
The stochasticity comes in at the binding to the submembrane.
Yeah.
It's the only
yeah.
place where.
Well, I mean, there's also diffusive noise, right? There's conserved diffusive noise, but the main thing would be multiple.
Times at the membrane.
Yeah. But anyway, this is, I think, not the way to go because it's very difficult. I'm not saying you couldn't do it, but it's hard, right?
Usually it comes out in a weak noise limit that turns out to be a problem, but of course you may...
Yeah, this is not weak Lois limit. That's the problem. Weak Lois limit, fine, yeah. Right? Obviously you can do this, but the problem is we're not in a weak Lois, at least not in large regions of the cell. Yeah. So what we did instead is a discrete particle approach. So basically, it's pretty crude. We turned the model we had before, which is a continuous PDE model, into a discrete particle model, stuff hopping back and forth and binding and unbinding. And that immediately, because we have probabilities involved, has full fluctuations built in.
Now the dimension might be covered.
Now the dimension is covered. And again, we're just doing a one-dimensional model.
Right,
and
so the big differences between 1 and 2D. You know,
it's probably a big difference. So we
it's less effect in 2 or
3D. Yes. Okay. I mean, it's,
yeah, if you average over the entire
Yes, that's certainly true. So, I mean, I think one wants to be cautious in what you extract from this sort of thing, because I only want to extract some sort of general effects. I don't want to go for anything very detailed, because as Eshel points out, I mean,
in some sense, it's not a because when you are projecting to one dimension, it's not discrete units anymore in one dimension.
Right. And also that there are other things you have to bear in mind, like, you know, these proteins have finite size, right? I mean, they're, as I said before, they're about 5 nanometers long. So that means you shouldn't use too many lattice sites, right? And there's a whole issue of, you know, how do I discretize this thing properly? And there are a bunch of issues to do with how you actually do a stochastic simulation of cellular processes, which I think are poorly under control to the best. Yes, even if you did it in 3D, you know, how do you take your lattice size? But no, I take your point. So there are hopefully a few things, sort of simple things that we can extract from this kind of crude model, and which would I think play a role in any pattern-forming system like this, which has a small number of particles, and is could be operating at a cellular level. One of which is a fluctuation-driven instability. I don't think that's very surprising for people from a statistical physics background. This is just saying that for some parameter values, the noise is essential for the generation of patterns. So basically, the noise is simply renormalizing all the parameters in your theory and shifting around the phase diagram slightly, so that, well, not slightly, but quite a lot sometimes, so there's some region of the parameter space where before you had no pattern, but because of the effects of the noise, they've now shifted it, so now you do get a pattern forming. So in a sense, there are some regions where the noise is essential for generation of patterns. And this, for some parameters, is exactly what you get. And you can see that here. Here I've plotted the density of min d from one end of the cell to the other end of the cell. And the sort of the line which is oscillating is a stochastic simulation, and the dotted line is the PDE simulation with equivalent parameters. So I've changed all the probabilities back into rates, okay, and compared the two. And you can see that even though I tried to kickstart the PDE model by starting them all at one end of the cell, which is why this ratio starts off being very small, it decays back to unity, which is homogeneous.
But for non-noise, you have no isolation, then you get isolation.
Yes.
Does that disappear again?
No, it's perfectly stable. Just continues oscillating.
More noise, more coherent oscillations?
I'm sorry?
If you add more and more noise, does it go away?
Well, I mean, when you say add more and more noise, I mean, you can't really... The noise is coming from the small number. Yes, if you make n smaller and smaller, eventually it will stop. Right? Obviously, if you have one particle, right, it's not going to work anymore. Right?
So, is there optimal? Do you think there's optimal?
Exactly, I'm coming to that. Right? Beginning, yeah. So this is what happens actually at 200, which is pretty much at the bottom. If you go any lower than that, then it sort of stops. The noise kills everything. But it is, the thing I wanted to point out is actually these oscillations still continue even at quite low numbers, which is sort of interesting. And even at 1500, which is around the level which you see in the bacteria, again, I don't want you to take that too seriously because this is a one-dimensional model, but nevertheless, it's some indication that this sort of similar effect happens even at higher concentrations, you get this, the same sort of thing. So in principle, I'm saying the cell can exploit fluctuation effects to do things that it couldn't do if it were in a noise-free environment. Now, just to be clear, I am not saying that the MIN system works this way, okay? I'm simply saying that this is the kind of effect that you could generically expect in a pattern formation system at a cellular level with order of 1,000 proteins, okay?
So the answer to Peter's question is that what you're doing is similar to what he did in the case that he presented of induced population and optimization of the number.
Oh, right. Okay, I should have come to your talk. Right. That's similar stuff then. Because the next side is I think...
At one point,
yeah.
If you would change your parameters,
yes,
you would get oscillations. Now, what you're telling is if you choose parameters which in the... In your previous model, not lead to oscillations.
Yes.
Deterministically.
Deterministically not, then you add noise and you come to oscillations.
Yes, exactly.
Because you've effectively changed
but
the parameters.
Yes. Your parameters were free in some sense. So at the moment, there's no reason to jump to this stochastic model. You could say, okay, let's renormalize.
Yeah.
If you would know the microscopic parameters.
Okay, I mean, I'm
you could renormalize them.
Sure, I mean, in principle, that's what's going on. When you add the noise to it, you're renormalizing all the parameters, and you're just shifting the boundary between oscillation and no oscillation. I mean, I don't think it's very surprising. This is the sort of thing that happens all the time when you add noise. I'm just saying that in this context, you know, there may be a biological application to it in some circumstances.
But there's a different mechanism of noise than that. I mean, what you and Werner talked about is that the noise renormalizes the parameters and shifts you around in the phase diagram.
Yeah.
But there's a different effect also, which is the one that
Martin Flicking.
Talked about.
Yeah.
And that is. If you have a parameter space where there's non-uniqueness of solutions, there is an oscillatory solution and a non-oscillatory solution.
Right.
Then what the noise might do is change your position in terms of being in a different
perspective. Yes, yes, exactly.
And that's what's called spontaneous nucleation of oscillations.
Right.
So I mean, there it's just putting you in the attractor
of the
oscillatory solution,
I mean,
but not changing what the solutions are.
Right. Right. I mean, I don't think the noise here really changes the solution. You still get the same kind of oscillations. back and forth.
Well, but it may generate your bifurcation at the calcium case. There are new branches which you don't have.
Right. Okay. That maybe I haven't done a systematic investigation of the phase space here to know that, because
you want to show that the number or the fluctuation optimizes the
modifier. I haven't gone. This is what I'm saying now. Yes, right. Okay, I am saying that. Well, I'm saying there's some evidence of that. Okay, because what I'm putting here is a histogram of the location of the min d density minimum. So for each oscillation cycle, so it starts here, goes over here, comes back here, and I say on that one oscillation cycle, where does the cell think its middle is? So I note that down, then repeat this many times and build up a histogram of where the cell thinks its middle is as a function of the number of protein copies, 200, 400, 800, and 1500. And you can see, as you might expect, as you increase the number of copies, it gets better. You know, if you're at 200, it sometimes completely screws up. And it thinks its middle is at the end, which is obviously fairly bad for the cell. It will put its division set in completely the wrong location. By the time you get up to around 1,500, which is what you seem to get in real E. coli, although again, there's the caveat about this being one-dimensional, the distribution is much sharper, and it effectively never does it at the ends. So you can see that you can make some kind of argument for an optimization, that it can't be using order of 200. It can't, even in principle, this is not going to work because the errors are going to be too large. And remember, there are multiple of these oscillation cycles between division events, 20 or 30 oscillations. And if it gets it wrong even once, then it can start to nucleate the FTZ protein in the wrong location. Okay, so it's got to be accurate. This is kind of saying that, well, maybe it really does have to have 1,000 or 1,500 to get it that accurate. But if you made more, then all you'd be doing is tightening up this distribution, and you could argue, well, why would the cell care particularly about whether it's 2% accurate or 0.5% accurate?
What is it effects? I mean, when you say if you get it wrong once, there would already be a problem. Is there any experimental evidence that
this
is really true?
Yes. Because what people have done is if you interfere with the concentrations of these proteins, you can slow down the oscillation cycle, and so you can adjust its period. And what's observed, that if you make the period slower than about 120 or 150 seconds, then it starts to nucleate the FTZ in the wrong location. Because this FTZ protein is averaging over a certain time window of where these proteins are.
Right.
And this averaging period is clearly about 90 seconds. Right. So if it gets this wrong once,
it's not a problem because it averages.
Yeah, no, but this is already averaged over one oscillation cycle. So for that oscillation cycle, it thinks its minimum is in the wrong place. And that oscillation cycle is about 90 seconds. And the reason why I averaged over one oscillation cycle is that's because what the data told me, because that's the period that it's averaging over. Okay, so that's why I chose that. So I think this could be significant. I'm not saying that there aren't other reasons why it's using 1,500 protein copies. There clearly are. But there's also, part of the explanation is coming from the fluctuations. Okay, that's all I'm claiming. Okay. Right. So this is some new information which has only come out very recently in the last couple of months, and it's basically the reason why I said all the models are wrong, because none of them really have this in them, and you can argue about how significant it is and so on, but let me just tell you what it is. The recent observation is from Larry Rothfield's lab in Connecticut, I think, was that these min proteins are not just some sort of blob, on the membrane. They're actually highly organized on the membrane, and they actually form themselves into helices. This is what you're supposed to be able to see from this diagram here. This is, I think, min-D GFP, but now they've done a better job of imaging it.
Two photon?
I don't know. I don't know the details of the imaging. I'd have to go and look that up. But they did this sort of slicing through it and then did some kind of image analysis on it to improve the resolution. And what they claimed was that they could see, you could see these sort of blobs, and the idea is there's some kind of helix winding around inside the cell here. And this is not in any of the models, okay, this helix. I'm going to be perfectly upfront about that. So that's bad. In principle, you want to improve the models to include this. But it does justify a couple of things. The first, remember, is the fact that the models, all of them, require the membrane diffusion to be very low. And that's now perfectly natural if these proteins are stuck inside a filament. They can't move, okay, because they're in this filament. It's not like they're on their own. That kind of guarantees the diffusion constant on the membrane is going to be much smaller. The second feature, I guess, is a bit more hand-waving, but it's now clear there is kind of a one-dimensional object on the interior of the membrane. And maybe this is at least partly explaining why these 1D models are working better than you would expect, because it's kind of a one-dimensional object on the membrane. It's not sort of forming a cluster all over the surface of the membrane. It's just forming a single filament, or maybe two filaments. So.
But the relationship between the membrane and the bulk,
yes,
is geometric.
That, I'm not saying this is a complete explanation.
I must admit that, you know, I would have thought it makes the geometry less model, which your so-called one-dimensional model is one that doesn't have geometry.
Right, but these things are all attaching themselves into a line. Okay, so it's more one-dimensional than it was before.
But it lacks geometry.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is why the one-dimensional model is all working great. I'm just saying this is, you know, maybe an indication of why it's working better than you would thought.
Periodic boundary condition, right? You go like this.
Well, no one.
That's not what I'm talking. The point is that the relationship between the membrane and the bulk is a geometric one, which is completely.
Yes, I agree with that.
It's even more geometric.
Right.
Anyway,
we're arguing. Well,
at the end, I think what your second thing says is exactly point number one. I mean, in respect to your model, you say that there is a Joule membrane diffusion constants.
Yes.
That's really what you can say. The second one, whether it's one unit, you don't know anything about
can
it.
Can it be that they diffuse just on the membrane?
Sorry, do they?
Can it be only a membrane effect?
Well, these
only on the membrane, and what we see is if bulk is just at the two sides of the membrane.
Well, as far as I know, these filaments are simply on the inside of the membrane. Okay,
yeah, on the membrane. I mean, on the inside
of the membrane.
Not and in the bulk.
They're not in the bulk. No, these filaments are not in the bulk. They're all on the membrane.
Maybe there is no diffusion of this in the bulk that participate in the oscillation. Can it be? Or can you rule it out from the observation? I'm not saying that this is reasonable but...
No, you have to have diffusion in the cytoplasm. That's essential for the model. If you take that out, then you won't get anything, right?
You need two diffusion constants, right?
Yeah, and I need rapid diffusion of min D and min E in the cytoplasm.
The diffusion on the surface of the membrane.
Oh!
That you have pass on the membrane, which is fast.
Oh, I see what you mean.
It's hard to tell from the experiment.
It's hard to tell from the experiment. All I can say is that the assumptions built into all the models are the opposite of that, and they seem to work quite nicely. So I'd say there's no evidence for what, although I couldn't completely rule it out. Okay. All right, so that's what I wanted to say about E. coli. Now I don't know, I seem to be going quite slowly. I mean, I was going to say something about B. subtilis, which I think is different. And I think this question of filaments may have some bearing on what's happening in B. subtilis. Although what I'm going to say in B. subtilis is a little bit more, I guess, speculative than what I've said about E. coli. There's a bit less data in B. subtilis. I've been a bit more subtle, indeed. Okay, so B. subtilis. So, as I think I said at the beginning, it has min C and it has min D, but it doesn't have min E. Instead, it has another protein, which is called DIV4A, which is completely unrelated to min E. The structure of the proteins is different. And it's observed there are no oscillations in B. subtilis anymore. So forget about all the stuff about oscillations. It doesn't work like that anymore. It's different. And what seems to happen is that min C and min D play the same roles as before, right? Min C blocks foot C, min D recruits min C to the membrane. So that's the same as before. But what seems to happen is that DIV4A is anchored to the poles. It localizes itself to the poles, and it anchors min C and min D to the poles. And furthermore, all of these proteins seem to have some affinity for the division apparatus. So this is a picture of B. subtilis, I think from Errington's lab in Oxford. And what you can see that the cell mark C here is one which is not dividing at the moment. And you can see that these proteins are localized at the end of the cell. This is min D. So it's localized at the end of the cell. But this cell here is now dividing. So it's formed a division septum. And you can now see there's a third bright patch in the center of the cell. So what's happened is the min C and the min D and also DIV4A started out at the end of the cell, but when the cell starts to divide, some of it's relocated to the center of the cell. Okay, that's the interpretation. So this immediately suggests one quite simple explanation of what's going on, because these proteins are at the end of the cell. The cell starts to divide, they relocate to the middle, and then when the cell's finished dividing, the division septum has become the new pole. Because remember, the cell's dividing in the center, and that's becoming a new end of the cell. So through this mechanism of always relocating to the cell ends, and then relocating to the cell division apparatus, the cell can make sure the ends of the cell are always marked, okay, just by this way of homing in on the division apparatus. So this seems a really simple way of guaranteeing that division never happens at the end of the cell, because it just always goes to where the cell is dividing. So it seems that this is a really trivial problem. How does B. subtilis prevent polar division? It does it by this really simple mechanism. But that's not the whole story. And nature has provided us with a really nice way of getting around this problem that the proteins always localize to the division site. Because you can have some very nice experiments that have been done this year is protein localization in outgrowing spores. Now, so remember what happens when you have a spore is you starve the bacterial cell, it forms this tiny spore, and then the rest of the cell lyses, and then the spore can last, you know, a long time and in harsh conditions. And then when you give it nutrients, the spore will regerminate and form a new bacterial cell. But the big advantage of going through this process in this case is that the new cell that germinates from the spore doesn't have any record of where previous divisions happened. So it can't use any information from where the previous end of the cell was from previous cell division. Because as far as that cell is concerned, there were no previous cell divisions because it was completely regenerated from growing out from a spore. So the previous explanation I told you can't be enough, because cells that grow out from spores don't have any pre-existing positional information. So there has to be something else.
Which makes much more sense, because you had to start somewhere.
You have to start, indeed. And you can also worry about whether this idea of always going to where the end was and relocating the division apparatus, how robust is that? If it makes a mistake once, the ends aren't going to be marked and it's going to have problems down the line.
We still don't understand how it relocates it anyway.
How it found the center.
Yeah, exactly.
You haven't answered the question.
No, I haven't. Okay, that's an important point. I haven't answered the question how it finds the center. Right. So what I'm going to tell you about here is how it blocks the ends.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
And then the different question is how does it accurately locate the center? And I can't answer that at the moment. In the absence of oscillation. Which is the first half of the talk. So I can answer why I think it blocks the ends, but and at least in sufficiently short cells, I can sort of see how it marks the center. But I'll come on to that in a second. But let me just show you these experiments. This is DIV4A localization, an outgrowing spore. So this is the initial spore, and it's grown out into a normal bacteria. And this bright blob here is a spore cap, so ignore that. But you can see that this DIV4A protein has very rapidly localized the ends of the cell. Had no problem getting there immediately after spore outgrowth. So we want to understand how that happens. The other thing you'll notice here, so this is quite a long cell. This is about 15 microns. And you'll notice there seems to be a big difference here from what we saw in E. coli. There seems to be no evidence at all for a characteristic wavelength. So if there were a characteristic wavelength, I'd expect another bright blob to have appeared in the middle. And I don't see that at all. And these are some other mutants where they've deleted various other proteins. And here it's dividing, so ignore that one. And this one it can't divide because it's had FTC deleted, and there's no evidence of a characteristic wavelength appearing. Okay, so it seems that there has to be a different explanation for what's going on.
Well, one thing to notice is also that the shape, you know, by some reason they don't go round; they actually get elongated.
You mean? That's just because it just keeps on growing. That's the same as E. coli; it just keeps on growing lengthwise.
It says FTC, that means
FTC
is gone.
That means FTC is deleted,
but
so it can't divide.
But you see when they see it go from the spore already,
yeah,
in this first step, it basically has just changed shape. It hasn't really grown anything.
Well, it does change shape a bit. I mean, the initial spore is actually ellipsoid in B. subtilis.
Well, so that's the initial thing when it germinates. It has to change the membrane.
Yes.
So
it breaks out. I mean, you can see the spore cap being forced out here.
Yeah, okay. So it changes the membrane.
Yeah, it has to change its membrane.
Yeah. So it has its very hard capsule.
Like, it has this very hard caps, and then it automatically makes a shape.
Right, right. But we want to understand how these proteins get to the ends of the cell. That's really.
We know the shape. Okay.
But we know the shape, yeah.
It seems that as they change the membrane, the new membrane already has the marks.
Right.
Yes, exactly. That's what we want to understand, right? When you know, how do those marks get there, right? Because as far as anyone knows, there's no marker there from any previous event. Okay, so how do the proteins get there? Okay.
Well, but they're ends.
Exactly.
It's actually different than.
Precisely. Well, okay. They're not biochemically. They're not different. as far as anyone knows. Now, normally in bacterial cells, the ends are different biochemically, because, for example, cell wall isn't synthesized at the poles of the cell. It's only synthesized along the cylinder. But that's only in cells which have, you know, which have come from previous cell division events. In these bacterial spores, everything's been synthesized at the same time in the outgrowing spore.
What makes a chemical?
So this is, well, this is what I there is a degree of positional information in the spore, and that the spore is ellipsoid. Okay, so it already has a shape, a specific shape to it. And you can ask the question, how is the spore ellipsoidally shaped? And I don't know the answer to that, okay? But I'm going to use the information.
Spores that are not ellipsoid, that are round.
No, but B. subtilis is ellipsoid.
But in the B. subtilis, there
yes.
are many.
Oh, there are many which are round. I'm not talking about round cells in this talk. That's a different issue, which is interesting, but different, okay? So what I'm going to try and... Well, this is more speculative, and there isn't ever direct evidence for all of this. There's evidence for some of it, so let me take you through it. The idea is here that, again, these filaments are important, and that the cell is using the fact that the end of the cell is a high curvature region where the cell's, you know, bending over, right? So it's a region of higher curvature. And you can imagine that if you have filaments, particularly if they're straight filaments, then they won't particularly want to bend around the end of the cell. Now, it's known that these... Not only do these the min proteins form filaments, but these filaments that they seem to be sort of two filaments wound around one another, and that they're fairly straight, at least in vitro experiments. So the assumption that's built into this model is that these filaments don't want to bend around the ends of the cell. Okay, there's some, you know, energy cost for that, and so they're quite keen not to do it. And you don't need a massive effect. All I need is like a factor of two or something, not a big effect. Just some small inhibition of the stuff wrapping around the end.
So what are you saying? We really understand the shape of this bacterium subtilis. We actually understand why, even if the membrane is everywhere the same, this thing makes a rod with two caps.
No, I'm not saying that.
But then what do you imply here? You imply that if we know that the shape is a
I'm saying
ellipsoid,
that if the shape is ellipsoid or it has a region of high curvature, then this is how proteins get to recognize where that region is.
But you
First you need to form that shape, and I can't answer that question at the moment. It's a different question. I mean, my suspicion might be, because I know that the B. subtilis spore is ellipsoid, there might be some simple biophysical explanation as to why it's in ellipsoid.
No, I'm talking not only about the spore, I'm talking about afterwards. You just told me that the proteins in the cell membrane are everywhere the same. So why should it keep that shape? Why shouldn't it just go round? Why shouldn't it just decide,
I get different geometry? Okay, there is stuff known about that. Okay, what happens is, it goes back to this idea of the bacteria having a cytoskeleton. What basically happens is there are a bunch of proteins that again form themselves into helices along the cell membrane, but not really at the ends. And what happens then is that the cell wall is synthesized at locations along this helix. So it grows along the cylindrical length of the cell, but keeps the poles, the sort of hemispherical pairs, biochemically inert. And that's how it maintains its shape. Okay? But if you're asking the question, how is it that the initial spore gets to be ellipsoid? Because the spore is created in a sort of what's called a spore compartment at the end of the cell. And how the spore ends up having ellipsoid shape, I don't know. I think is an interesting question.
I went to try to bring a picture, but I don't have a hard copy. I have only a slide of pictures that we took using transmission electron microscope.
Right.
So you can do ultrasound of the pregnant bacteria with the spore inside before they break open.
Right.
And I show you the pictures, and you can see it seems that when they prepare their new baby, they already mark its head and tail and all this thing during the process that they make the spore.
Right.
So it might be that it's already marked, pre-marked before.
It's possible. All I'd say is in B. subtilis, that no one's ever there's no evidence that no one's ever said anything of that sort.
It's what we have is Panibacillus lentiformis, which is bacteria that we developed, but subgroup of the bacillus.
Right.
And there is a big difference between the gram positive and gram negative. And
yes.
Big difference between the E. coli and the bacillus.
Yes.
So some of them sporulate and some others do not sporulate.
Yes, of course.
That's why they have to have different mechanisms and to be able to mark it, I believe, when they prepare the spore.
Right. Well, it's possible. I mean, there's maybe more than one explanation about how this works. I mean,
you're not addressing that issue.
I mean, I'm addressing the issue of once
given a shape.
Yeah.
How does it
recognize the end? There's one possible way in which it could do it without there being any particular marker at the end of the cell. I mean, you could ask then, okay, so how does your marker find the end? You know, you're saying there are these markers in the spore. How do the markers find the end, right? There has to be, you know, there has to be some explanation for how they find the end. You know, you can't just always rely on a pre-existing marker.
Well, you say there's no pre-existing marker for this phenomenon.
Well, at least,
the cell itself,
okay. The cell itself has geometrical information that marks the end of the cell, but not biochemical.
The only difference is that what you say is that the pre-mark is the oval shape of the spore.
Yes.
Because the curvature marking.
Yes.
What I'm trying to tell you is that they do not rely on it. They make really more pronounced marker, but for your model it doesn't matter if it's the curvature or you have some mark. So you have sites which probably are marked.
Right.
Okay, that's the point. And they have to mark it because for the spore to open. Because the spore will get a noise signal from outside.
Mm-hmm.
It should not germinate. Only when after some
he's
time.
He's not talking about.
Yeah, but these are important.
He's not talking about spores. He's talking about the bacterium itself.
No, he talks.
I'm talking about a bacteria that's grown out from a spore.
Grown out from the spore. That's a very exciting, because now he's talking not about bacteria that it's there, but the initial stage, the embryonic stage of the bacteria.
Well, I think one thing that is important is that different bacteria will probably do these things different ways. I'm not saying that this is the one and unique mechanism for identifying the end of the cell. There are probably a diversity of mechanisms which it's going to use.
So to test your thing, is there any way for people that do biology actually have to change the cell shape by biochemical means?
Yeah, you can change
it back and then to see whether
you can change this. People have actually, I mean, you can see that in this slide. People here, they've deleted PBB. Which is penicillin binding protein, which is a cell wall protein, and you can see the thing starting to buckle. Okay, so let me think about that.
If you include the curvature induced, what you could do is you could take a cell,
then
that goes away.
All I would say is that there is evidence from different experiments that DIV4A seems to localize in regions of high curvature. There's a completely different case, which I saw, and I'm going to get the situation wrong, but it's some bacteria that forms kind of branching structures, and they looked at the localization of DIV4A, and it seemed to like to come in at regions that were highly curved. So I have to go and look up the details of that, because I haven't, but I think that there is some evidence for this. It's not overwhelming, but let me tell you what it is, okay? So the idea is that if these things form into filaments, then they may not want to bind at the end of the cell, because that's high curvature. And I'm going to put this into a model with a similar kind of structure before. So now I have two equations for MIND-D and two equations for DIV4A. And again, I had a diffusive structure, and I have various binding and unbinding terms. So first of all, I allow MIND-D to bind. There's some kind of saturation term, and this binding is now position dependent. So it doesn't want to bind at the end of the cell, which is why there's now a function of X. Okay. I also allow it to unbind, and this rate of unbinding is suppressed by DIV4A, which is this denominator here. And it's known that DIV4A stabilizes MIND-D, so that's reasonable. Now the DIV4A, we allow it to bind to the membrane, again some saturation, and then there's this funny looking gradient term here. The reason I put that in as a gradient term is that DIV4A probably wants to bind to the end of MIND-D fibers. Doesn't want to bind where there's a high concentration of them, it wants to bind to their ends, okay? And that basically induces a coupling to the gradient, because it wants to bind to the edges of clusters as opposed to their centers. So that's a crude way of taking that into account. And there's experimental data which seems to indicate that they seem to want to bind to the ends.
So they could be gradient squared?
It could be, yes, sure. You can make that kind of change, definitely. But that's what I put in with the modular signs. I'm sure there are other things you could dream up. And then again, you allow DIV4A to unbind, but again, it self-stabilizes, and there's experimental evidence for that DIV4A oligomerizes. So it sort of wants to form clusters that are self-stabilized. So basically, the idea here is that DIV4A wants to bind to the edges of MIND-D clusters, so we have this coupling to the gradient. And then we see what this does. And again, I put in this fact that MIND-D actually wants to bind less to the ends, And that's rather counterintuitive, because I'm saying that MinD will end up with a higher concentration of the cell ends, even though it initially wants to bind there less. So what basically is happening in this model is that the MinD is binding to the membrane, but doesn't want to bind at the end because of the curvature. That sets up a gradient at the end of the cell, because it wants to bind here but not there. That means the DIV4A comes in and stabilizes that region, and it ends up there being a higher concentration in that region. Okay, that's the mechanism.
If you were to write down the term lambda A of X, like you would write down lambda D of X, it's also kind of, and you would like to make this a kind of dynamic.
Right, I mean, you could in principle allow the DIV4A not to bind at the ends as well. The reason why...
I leave out the gradient term. You could...
I see what you mean.
You could mimic...
Yes, I could mimic it in that way. Sure, sure.
And so, so in one sense, it senses the concentration, whereas in LDX, it is a constant function.
Yeah.
It doesn't look at any...
Yeah, I mean, you could do that. Put in a position-dependent binding here, but I thought this... That's making more assumptions somehow. So I thought this was a bit simpler. Yeah. But I mean, this
what
is all.
Lambda primes?
These are simply saying that there's a sort of maximal concentration locally on the cell surface. So when the concentration gets too high, binding becomes inhibited. That seems fairly natural. Okay. Oops. So let me show you what happens when you put that into the computer and simulate it. So this is a.
You have to choose a lambda D of X.
I make it sort of order one. Everywhere in the body of the cell, and it's basically a half at the ends for the sites closest to the end. That's all. I mean, it's very crude, very simple. So I only need a factor of two, not much, actually. Then what happens is that, so this is a simulated outgrowing spore, so space-time diagrams. Here in the computer, the spore starting off at 1 micron, and it ends up at 10 microns. And you can see, as claimed, the stuff wants to localize to the ends of the cell, and you get this kind of random, interesting-looking pattern in the center. And if you do a snapshot across here, then you see this kind of interesting barcode type pattern. It wants to come in at the ends, and there's kind of a random sort of distribution in the center. And if you compare that to the experiments, you see a high concentration at the end, then kind of a random splodgy distribution in the middle. So it's maybe not so far away.
So this randomness comes from the initial condition?
I think basically this system is spatial-temporally chaotic in the interior. Actually, that's why you end up with a very speckled-looking pattern. That's what it looks like to me. Looks a bit like the Comets-Ginzburg-Lander equation, actually, in some ways. So, but I mean, I know that's pure speculation. I don't know anything about that. All I'm saying is that when you do a snapshot of this, you get this barcode, and you can also see that these clusters in the interior seem to propagate, and that's basically because of the coupling to the density. So I think it would be one way you could test this theory is by looking more closely at this and seeing, well, does this blob move or not? Yeah. And that would be a good test whether there's anything to this theory or not. And you can also do the same thing of looking at the averages now of the MinD and the DIV4A concentration. So this is in a 2 micron cell, 4 micron, 8 micron. You can see in a short cell there's this peak close to the ends and a dip in the middle. These are time averages over 90 seconds. So basically one oscillation cycle again. Okay.
Oscillation.
I'm getting confused. I'm using the same average as what I used in E. coli, because in E. coli I know that the FTSE averages over about 90 seconds. Since I have no information about how long FTSE and B. subtilis averages over, I'm using the same number, which is it's reasonable that it should be a minute or two. Okay, that's the best information I have, because there's no data on how long it uses. Okay. If it were longer, this would get better. It would be a sharper minimum. So in a sense, 90 seconds is quite short. I mean, you might argue if it's longer, it will do better. But the point I'm trying to make is that in longer cells, it has a problem identifying the center. So at 4 microns, it's not doing it very well. At 8 microns, it's doing it really rather badly. So this thing is basically just marking the ends of the cell. And that seems to agree with the experiments. The experiments, you seem to have this bright blob at the either end and basically not much in the center. And it's hard to imagine that in this cell, the center is being marked with high accuracy. And in fact, there are other reasons to do with when you knock out the MIN DIV4A system. It can still find the middle, not with as good an accuracy as before, but it can still find it with reasonable accuracy. So there's something else going on in addition to this. okay, which I don't know what that is. I don't think anyone knows what it is. So I mean, that's a, you know, that's my guess as to what might be happening in subtlets. But I agree, it's a bit speculative, and I'm going slightly out on a limb. I'm just trying to extrapolate what I know from E. coli. But what I do know is that it, I think, is very different biophysics, which is going into to this, because there's no characteristic wavelength in this system, as far as I can tell. So let me just summarize finally. I've gone on for a long time. So reaction diffusion system in E. coli, we've had these Turing patterns, we've looked at the fluctuations. I think it's different in B. subtilis, and this is, I think, these are all really excellent examples of kind of self-organized dynamics that are going on in bacteria. And it also shows there are different ways of solving the same problem. And if you can ask, why is B. subtilis using a different mechanism, I think it's because it forms spores. So when it forms a spore, it doesn't do a central division event, it does a polar division event. So it has to completely reorganize the location of proteins inside the cell. And if it's using the MinCDE system, that's quite difficult to do. If you're using this Div4A system, all you need is another protein to compete with the Min proteins to bind to Div4A. And actually, there's already a protein which is known to do that. It's called RAC-A. So I think this is the reason why subtlis is using a different mechanism, but I'm speculating a bit. So finally, I'd like to thank Andrew Rutenberg, with whom I started this work when I was a postdoc in Vancouver, and we worked on the PDE and the stochastic models. Simon DeVette was a student of Andrew's, and he worked on numerics for the PDE model. And lastly, I should thank people who pay me. So thanks for listening.